was a very central idea in Buddhist practice. And our capacity to be centered, calm, mindful, attentive, concentrated in our meditation is meant as an aid, as support for our ability to let go or to have letting go happen. The Buddhist analysis of the human condition, human suffering, is that much of our suffering occurs by or is compounded by the degree to which our hearts and our minds contract, get tight, hold on. And anyone who does meditation, who watches their own mind and heart, becomes very familiar to the degree to which there's a lot of momentum, a lot of holding on, a lot of preoccupation that has its own life. And that it's very painful to be filled with resentment. Resentment is anger, which is stuck, which is being held onto. Sometimes there's many kinds of depression, but sometimes depression is a kind of holding on to sadness. Sometimes it's a kind of holding on to anger, holding on and pushing it down. We want things to be a certain way. The wanting mind is very painful if you pay careful attention. If you're constantly following through on the wanting mind, you know, getting, or trying to get, maybe you don't see the pain and always wanting, always grasping. But if you sit quietly for a moment and just start feeling what it's actually like to be grasping and wanting, it can actually feel quite painful. So at the very center of human suffering is this issue of grasping or clinging. And to the degree to which that's the case, then letting go of that clinging is a really central aspect of Buddhist practice. And Buddhism all of Buddhism is support for our ability to begin letting go, to not to cling. Now, of course, this takes developing a very trusting presence in life. If we're constantly afraid or defensive or ambitious or hateful, it's a little bit hard sometimes to get down to the core central graspings that make up who we are. So letting go. I don't teach letting go very often. And in a sense, letting go maybe isn't the most suited practice, isn't like a universal practice that people should always do or can always do. But I think in particular phases in a person's life, the practice of letting go can be very useful. For some people who find their minds very scattered or racing or very busy, and it's very hard to get centered or settled, sometimes the practice of letting go is really great. Just whatever concern arises, whatever preoccupation, whatever grasping, whatever fear, whatever thoughts, ideas that appear, just to let go. And even at first, it might just be a little bit of loosening the grasp, loosening kind of the way in which we're so propelled into kind of compulsive relationship with our thoughts or concerns. And slowly, that kind of letting go can slowly loosen up our attachments enough so that then we can kind of settle down. And then we switch from a letting go practice to a letting be practice, which some Buddhist teachers feel is a little bit more profound than the practice of letting go. You just let things be. But letting be and letting go are very comparable. Because what we're letting go of in Buddhist practice is we're not, and this is where there's often a misunderstanding, we're not letting go of things. We're letting go of our clinging to things. So the example which I probably used here before, if I grasp this bell and then want to make a beautiful sound, well, you know, maybe it's a beautiful sound, but it's not the sound you expect. But if I hold the bell lightly, loosely, then you can make a nice sound. So to let go of the bell, it means not to hold on, not to grasp it, but rather just to hold it lightly. And many people, when they encounter spiritual disciplines, will hear teachings like renunciation, letting go, surrender, and take them to mean that we have to actually let go of our money, our houses, our relationships or sex life or recreation, or we let go of all these things of the world. And certainly in our culture, A lot of us would be happier if we do let go of tangible things. There's so much consumption around us. But Buddhist practice is not about letting go of things as much as it is letting go of the attachment we have to things, the clinging, the grasping to things. And then what you decide to do with those things, once you're not grasping at it, is up to you. So if you know, if you're really really clinging to a particular, you know, what's a good thing to cling to these days? What is something someone's clung to last week or last day or today? That
coffee.
Now there's one that's caused a lot of suffering in people. Now it could be quite benign, attachment to coffee, but then you run out of coffee in the morning. You wake up in the morning, there's no coffee there. Oh my God! And then you jump in your car when you shouldn't be. You shouldn't be in your car when you haven't had your coffee, right? You're endangerment to society. And others, and so you're racing around like a maniac looking for your coffee, and then, you know, the stores run out of coffee, and then you kind of go into a fit in the store. And I know one person who gave up cigarette smoking when he showed up at 11:30 at night. At 11:30 at night, he discovered himself in the middle of a supermarket trying to buy cigarettes because he'd run out at home. And he noticed that he hadn't chosen to be there. It was an act of compulsion. His attachment and clinging to the addiction to the cigarettes was driving him. And when he woke up, in a sense, in the middle of the market, I don't want to live this way. And so he just then and there gave up his cigarettes. But coffee, you know, so it's possible not to have, in theory at least, unless you have a biological addiction, it's possible to let go of the attachment to coffee. And you see someone has if you smell the wonderful aroma of coffee, and say, well, that's nice, that's really pleasant to smell, I'll take it or leave it. And you might decide to take it, you might decide to leave it. I don't know if that's the best example. But the teaching here is the letting go doesn't necessarily entail letting go of things or people or money or whatever it is you let go, but to let go of something more profound, which is the relationship we have created with the things of the world. The relationship we've created of hate, the relationship we've created of fear, the relationships we have of addiction, of wanting, of desiring. All those relationships, when they're problematic, when they entail some level of grasping or contraction or tightening around it, that can be let go of, that movement of tightening. So I let go of the grasping to the bell, I'm still holding the bell. And one of the very important aspects of meditation practice is that in that we're sitting alone, we're sitting with our eyes closed, but sitting in a sense kind of not alone because we're sitting here in a group, but in that it's a very personal thing, meditation. It's something you do kind of an inward thing that we do. It's really about you and yourself. What goes on within you? What is your relationship to the world? What's your relationship to yourself? And to really to meet that, to see that, to wake up to that in a way that is much more honest than can be if you're actually constantly following through on the compulsive activities that we want, our desires and our fears and all that. And then to start noticing, and because we're sitting, it's very personal, say we're sitting with our eyes closed and quiet, our peace is not about what we can get, not the things we can get, but rather has to do with the relationship we have to the world. And it's possible to have a relationship to all the things of the world, including ourselves, where there's no tightening, no grasping, no wanting. Wanting, but no grasping, no clinging. So there's a practice of letting go. Whenever we find a preoccupation, an idea that we're trying to chase, desire that we want, something we don't want, some fear, whatever concerns arises, there's a practice, okay, I just let go of that. Let go of any clinging, any desire to pursue that. Let go of that thought, let go of that idea. Let go of any thoughts about the past. Someone once said that forgiveness is giving up all hope of a better past. To give up any hope for a better past. You know, you can't change your past usually. So the idea now, one of the reasons I don't teach letting go so often is because some people misunderstand letting go. The teaching of letting go, misunderstand it as meaning let go of things. And then people will inappropriately let go of things which maybe shouldn't be let go of. And people who get really gung-ho in spiritual practice, especially if they're, you know, really young or something, when I was in my 20s or whatever, people want to let go of, they want to give away. I've known people who want to give away all their money or give away all their clothes or give away, you know, just, or let go of, you know, all the relationships, or, you know, let go of their sex life or whatever, just to feel like there's something wrong with the things, and so you just want to let go of all those things, and they do so inappropriately. And inappropriate letting go usually comes back in unhealthy ways. You let go of your anger, and then you find out that you're always going around being judgmental. You let go of your judgments, and then you find out that you're always going around being depressed, and you could give up your depression. And the momentum of, you know, unless we really see clearly what's going on, it can be very dangerous to let go inappropriately if it's, you know, it's the things of the world. Also, letting go, one of the problems with letting go is that some people get really good at it. And especially people who've done a lot of meditation become really good sometimes at letting go. And then they can let go of things before they've really understood the thing they're letting go of. And so, for example, anger. I know people who've been able to let go of anger really easily. But all the conditions that stimulate them to get angry are still in place. And so 2 minutes later, they get angry again. Well, great, they can let go. 2 minutes later, they get angry again, they let go. But it's much wiser to actually study the conditions, to actually hang out with the anger sometimes, not let go of it too quickly, and get to know it so well you understand the conditions. You understand what it is that triggers the anger, the hurt or the fear or frustration or whatever it might be. And then to really understand that root, so that in the future those conditions don't trigger the same response. So sometimes letting go is done inappropriately. Sometimes it's done in a way that shortchanges our ability to understand deeply what's happening with us. But even so, letting go is a very profound practice. Ajahn Sumedho, who's one of the inspiring monastics in our kind of wider, in our kind of circles, he said that he spent 1 year of his monastic life only practicing letting go. Whatever arose, he just let go. Let go, let go, let go was his mantra. So that was the mantra I suggested for you tonight. It was the mantra of letting go as you breathed. What was that like for some of you to do? It'd be nice to hear a little bit and continue our discussion tonight based on your comments. Yes?
I kept kind of nodding off, like falling asleep, but then I'd catch myself and turn my back and remember what I was supposed to do. Yeah, I must have done that 50 times.
And you do this more often tonight because of this little mantra than usual?
Yes, never done that much before.
Uh-huh. Well, that should be very interesting. You might continue then for a while in your own practice doing this and see what happens. I don't want to... I mean, there's a number of reasons why that could be. I would take them all as being good signs and just keep it up until you understand better what's happening. Yeah, Ms. Smith.
I found it really very intense. I don't know. It was just very, very intense for me. I mean, there were different images of, you know, just letting go and letting go. They were more visual for me. And at one point, there was just the image of having all this luggage all over me. And I remember thinking it just, the ludicrousness of it, and just how, just having all this luggage, and it was as if it was Velcroed to me. So I would, on the let, you know, I could sometimes maybe loosen the Velcro a little bit, by the time I got to the luggage, it was pretty much mostly staying there, and so then I eventually let go of the idea of letting it go. And I don't know, at one point there was all this grief, and I was like, oh no, I have to like, I have to let all this grief go, you know, come out too, and so that was fearful, and I don't know, it was very intense.
It can be very intense. It's a powerful purification practice to let go, because it makes room for all the stuff inside of us that's been built up to come pouring out.
It definitely felt at one point, I guess that was partly when I got kind of emotional, was it felt like, you know, this is, you know, my deepest wish type thing, you know, and so then that made me, you know, get kind of emotional, because it felt so, you know, just the ludicrousness of having all this baggage and kind of the funniness of it, and just, you know, just really wanting this in a deep way, I guess.
Wanting to let go in a deep way.
Yeah.
Our deepest intimacy with life and ourselves is found in letting go. So I can well understand it's your deepest wish. Someone else? Yes, Jim.
It's interesting for me. What I found is that I do the mantra, and my mind would seem empty, and spontaneously, some story would arise. It was just, I don't know where it came from. It wasn't something that seemed, I don't know where it came from. And then I just let go of that, and I'd be empty for a little bit. And then another channel would click on. It's a little like channel surfing or something. In between the channels was the letting go, and then a new entertaining little thought or story or drama would sneak up on me. I mean, it wouldn't pop into my mind. I'd suddenly notice that I was entertaining myself, and then I'd let go of that. I guess what I realized at the end was the thing that I wasn't able to let go of was wanting it to stop. I mean, it just seemed like it just kept coming. You know, I mean, I thought at some point I'll just let go and another story won't appear. And that never happened. It just, for the whole time, and at fairly regular intervals, some other, you know, I was just off. It was just going again.
Well, part of the beauty of this kind of practice, I think you kind of touched into, is you said something like, finally I had to realize I had to let go of wanting it to be different, of wanting it to stop. Any thought, any desire, any wishes can be let go of. So if you're having thoughts about how it's not going right, you let go of those thoughts. If you have any thoughts about how right it's going, how well it's going, you let go of those thoughts. So you just left, you know, it's kind of, you know, with nothing. here I am. I can't do it right, I can't do it wrong. I just let go.
It seemed like the mind resisted being empty.
Yeah.
I mean, it spontaneously created something to...
There's many reasons why a mind resists being empty. I mean, minds think. That's kind of what they do. It's fine for them to think. And we're not supposed to necessarily stop the mind from thinking. But the idea of emptiness or silence or stillness can be very, very frightening for a mind which is used to always chasing after things. A mind that's been very busy and never knows how to be still, and kind of anxiety that kind of exists if we're always busy and busy, busy, busy. And it can be very disconcerting to kind of let go of that and kind of find ourselves disoriented, because we've been so oriented towards the things of the world through our desires or our dislikes or whatever it might be. Our sense of identity comes from our thoughts, our ideas. And so if we let go of story making and ideas, then the idea that, oh, I am this kind of person doesn't exist. for a moment at least. And that for some people is petrifying, because the whole way in which they orient themselves to the whole world around them is through the filter of, this is who I am. So rather than going to that kind of stillness or peace or silence or emptiness, they'd rather quickly make another story to fill it, because the stories are much more secure, they're familiar, even though they might be a little bit more painful. It's really a beautiful thing to discover the ability to be at peace without having to make any story at all, to have any ideas, to have anything you're clinging to, any kind of preoccupation. So you said that, you let go, and there'd be stillness or silence, and then immediately a story would come back up. There's a few things that are happening in that process. One is your strength, letting go is kind of like a muscle. And so you're strengthening that muscle, that ability to let go. And that might be very important in some circumstances in life where it's really challenging. Maybe not in meditation, but maybe you find yourself, I don't know where, but maybe you find yourself at work and something terrible happens, your boss is yelling at you or something, and I don't know what could happen, but it might be the appropriate response from you is to let go of something so you can be present in a more fully, more compassionate way. I practice letting go a lot these days now that I'm a father. My son's 2.5 and he's so demanding. And his needs, there's kind of an ultimatum quality to them. and they have to happen right now. And I have all my, things I like to do and things I feel are important. And I need to let go of so many things. And so my ability over the years to develop letting go is really helpful for me in my parenting, because then I can really, to some degree, be much more present for him, because I can know how to let go. If I don't let go, then I'm kind of resisting and resentful and holding, or if I don't, sometimes if I don't let go, then, it escalates and he suffers more and more, Later, I'll come later and do that, So by constantly, moment by moment, breath by breath, letting go, you're strengthening that muscle of letting go, which might be really useful some point later in your life when, you really need it. The other thing that happens is that as a generalization, the process of letting go, if it's done continuously for a long time, goes from grosser attachments to more and more subtle ones. And maybe it doesn't feel that way, it just seems like they're all kind of equally strong. And sometimes it's more like a spiral, they kind of get stronger and then weaker and stronger. But incrementally, you let go of one concern, and then the next strongest one appears. And then the next strongest one appears. And the next strongest one appears. Until you get frightened by the whole process, and then you get a really strong one. or bored or something. But it goes, so slowly, slowly, that's what we call our purification process. All these little concerns and momentums and desires and attachment get their moment in the light of your awareness, and you let go of them. Now, if you chase after a particular attachment, particular concern, and you get lost in a 15-minute story about it, then you've lost 15 minutes opportunity to let go of, 100 things. And maybe after 15 minutes you let go of that one thing. Great, that's nice. But, you could have done 100 things in that 15 minutes. And you would have got so much further in your purification process. So it's your choice, do you want to sit here and just... we like to be efficient in the modern America, right? So getting lost in your stories is not very efficient. Yes?
Since I have a lot of friends who work a lot, are overly concerned with success, and are really busy, I guess I'm trying to figure out what the lesson is for me, because I get upset about how they handle that area of my life. And I was thinking that maybe letting go of my judgment of, my values are different than theirs, even though I still want to relate to them because we have other things in common. But when that subject comes up, I feel like I immediately start criticizing in my mind that maybe they haven't reach balance in that area of the life. So, you know, this kind of tricky because the work is not a problem for me, but when it's about other people, so I think, I don't know, letting go of my judgment when that subject comes up.
That's a good question. You have to remember that letting go doesn't necessarily mean letting go of anything. It means letting go of our relationship to that thing. So you can have judgments, discriminations. You can understand what's going on with your friends and make it a certain level of discernment around that. But what you can let go of, not necessarily your judgment, but you can let go of your attachment to that judgment, your preoccupation with it, your clinging to it, your contraction around it. So judgment is a mixed word in our language because some of our movement to judge arises out of our pain, out of our contractedness, out of our hate and out of our judgments in these things to begin with. But some of judgment is just wise discernment, discrimination, wise discrimination. This is one thing and this is something else. So it's important to see that difference. But in your situation, maybe it's not necessarily letting go of your understanding of the situation, but rather letting go of the way in which you get ticked off by it, the way it irritates you, or let go of your fear around it, or let go of your insecurity in the relationship to that, or let go of your, I don't know what it is, that what gets triggered inside of you, but something gets triggered inside of you that you contract. Now, some people, you might find just letting go of the judgments entirely makes you feel more peaceful, but it also might make you dumber. I mean, it's, you know, you can go, again, judgment is an odd word to use, but some people I know give up their discerning ability to kind of see things clearly for what they are and say, this is not right, or this is painful, or this is not appropriate to. So they say, well, that's just painful for me to have those kinds of ideas, so I'm going to let go of all my discernment about life. And so they go around kind of numb to life. So you don't have to let go of your discernment about the situation, but you can certainly let go of any clinging to it. Does that make sense at all? It's easier almost to say let go of it all, let go of my discernment and judgment, because that's obvious. But that's why meditation is so important, something like meditation. Meditation is supposed to help us to see that middle ground between ourselves and our judgment, or ourselves and the things of the world that we want, where the attachment occurs.
Would you mean, for example, some parents, I noticed if their kids are doing something, you know, they're learning their own lessons, some parents are critical about it, and other parents just kind of, they don't approve, but they let them learn their lessons. Is that kind of like you're saying, like the relationship?
Maybe. Let me say it this way. I remember many years ago I had a girlfriend, and when she would drive me around, I would get very judgmental about her driving. And other people would drive, you know, I'd drive other people who drove as badly as she did, you know, and, you know, I would say, you know, well, whatever, you know, but when she drove, you know, and it's like, you know, how could you do this? And we'd enter these big arguments, you know, and I'd be really upset. And finally I realized that what was happening for me and why I was suffering was that because we were so close, she was my girlfriend, we felt really close to her, I identified with her. And how what she did in some subtle way said something about who I was. And so I wanted to stop her from doing that because I didn't want people to see me through her that way. That makes some sense? So my preoccupation with her driving had to do with my attachment, my clinging to my own self-image. Now I can see parents and homeworking to be the same thing. You know, some parents, it's their own image that they're protecting when they want their kids to be really successful at school. And so they get really anxious around what the kids are doing. And other parents who simply, with wise, clear discernment, are very strict with their kids, you have to do this, but there's nothing personal about it for them. So one of the wonderful lines that's by a poet named T.S. Eliot is the lines, "Teach me to care and not to care." And I think this is very pertinent to the idea of letting go. Teach me to care very intimately about life and myself and my friends. At the same time, teach me not to care, not to get contracted or tight around that. Not to let that disturb the quality of my mind. And one of the things we learn to do through, I think, Buddhist practice or meditation practice, is begin appreciating that the quality of our mind is a fluid situation. It can change quite a bit. And that our quality of our mind is maybe something we want to protect. And we don't want to have a mind that's full of fever of hate or fever of desire or fever of anxiety or all these fevers that, you know, we can beset the mind. We like to protect it so that it stays cool in a healthy way. So I don't know if I'm speaking to your concern anymore, but yes.
Could you speak some more about, you called it hovering on Monday, you were talking a little bit about it just now, the difference between you know, saying a mantra and just keeping the mind silent,
yeah,
versus learning something from it. I've had just a chatter mind all week that I've been able to, you know, by force keep it quiet with some sort of mantra, but then when I finally let it chatter, and like by accident,
yeah,
I figured out what it's actually saying.
Yeah.
It's great insight. So there's like, there's got to be some little way there that I'm not
getting. Yeah, generally in mindfulness practice, we don't practice letting go, but rather we practice letting be, and in the letting be, investigating the situation. So investigation is a very important part of mindfulness, to understand what's actually going on there. And in an investigation, we try to see what our relationship is to something. So in a chattering mind, for example, it might be more important for what you might let go of is not the chattering mind, but your irritation to chattering mind, or your idea that it's unspiritual to have a chattering mind, or you have all these ideas, a relationship we form to it. And then once we let go of all those surrounding ideas and just let the chattering mind be there by itself, letting it be just really clearly in and of itself, then we investigate it. We find out what's going on there. And then the art of mindfulness is to learn how to listen deeply, kind of maybe almost, you can maybe say silently, to that chattering and see underneath the words of what you're saying, what is the real concern? And most people will not ask themselves or explore what is the deeper concern underneath their chattering. And because they don't do that, that deeper underlying concern will keep you so active in those kind of chattering. And so so meditation is a wonderful place to kind of listen more deeply. What is really the concern here? So maybe what's going on with the chattering is that you're afraid. And so then what you have to do is not be concerned with the story of what you're chattering about, but to really connect deeply to your fear. And that's really what needs your attention. So one of the things we do in mindfulness is try to listen very attentively. What really wants our attention? What really needs our attention within us? And it's usually not what appears at the surface, but the surface is a symptom of what's deeper. Yes?
Can you say a little bit about where wanting falls in this? Just wanting and grasping.
Well, that's the crucial distinction is between wanting and grasping. Sometimes wanting gets bad press in Buddhist circles in Buddhist circles, the word desire and wanting are neutral words. They're multivalent words. If you're hungry, there's a natural desire to want to eat. If your bladder is full, there's a desire to go to the bathroom. There's a lot of desires we can have. You can desire all kinds of things. You can desire to go. And I have a wonderful desire. I have no shortage of desires, let me tell you. If I was able to follow through on every desire I had, just the desires I had today, I'd be busy for the rest of the year. I mean, the short desires are really cheap. And so I have a lot of desires. But those desires have no compulsion behind them. Oh, I say, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's nice. I mean, for example, driving over here, I saw these cars on the road. I have this little bit old car. I'm thinking maybe of getting a new car, and I saw these little cars. Oh, I'd like to have that car. No, I'd like to have that car. I'd like to have that car. I mean, boy, it's really easy to want to have cars. But there was absolutely no compulsion about it. You know, it's like, you know. And so the grasping is when there's a compulsion behind it. And you can't, when you're free, then you can let go of the desire. oh, there's a desire. Oh, okay. You know. And then if you can let go of the desire, if you have that ability, then your wisdom can come into play and you can see, is this really wise or not? But if there's compulsion as part of it, the wisdom doesn't have any chance to operate.
The difference between intention and reaction.
I see, right. So to intend intentionally with attention, to actually know what you're doing, is to respond wisely, and then but then to react habitually, automatically. So that's the real difference. So do you have the ability to have a desire without any compulsion at all? Just, wow, there's a desire. Okay, what's next? You have that ability. When don't you have that ability? Because certain situations you find yourself having that ability. In some situations you find yourself you don't have that ability. And it's very interesting, very important, I think, to discern the difference. If you get harried or frantic or afraid or anxious, you might actually have less free will in relationship to your desires. And when you're calm and peaceful, then, you know, you see a desire and say, well, you know, I don't need that. And so maybe you need, if you notice such a distinction, then maybe you need to be really careful when you find yourself in a situation where you're harried or frantic or anxious, to be careful with any decisions you make in that state. Because you know that you're more likely to act on compulsion rather than wisdom. Yes?
I've kind of noticed kind of a paradoxical quality to the difference between wanting and grasping. When I was younger, I kind of had this vision of, a strong vision of the kind of group of people I wanted to work with. I wanted to work with a team that was really, you know, together and connected and had a common vision. And it just got that idea in my head. And early on in my work career, I just really focused on that. And it was amazing how much further it got away. It just kept going away. And it was through a long cycle of learning to start to realize that my grasping for that was actually preventing me from getting closer to it. And then as I really started to work on saying, oh, that's interesting, you know, this doesn't seem to be coming together, then things started to come together. You know, I started to get into situations where a lot more of the things that I wanted were starting to appear. It was very counterintuitive.
Yeah, some people will go so far with experiences like that and kind of make a principle out of it, and the principle is that something like pursuing anything actively gets in the way of what you want. I mean, I think it's a little bit naive to say it in such an extreme way, but a lot of people have that experience that you're describing, especially like, for example, in relationships, in relationship to other people, like wanting to be liked by a lot of people, wanting everyone to like you or like. So we're constantly trying to be a certain way so people can like us. And the more we try to be a certain way, we're not being ourselves. So how can people like you? How can people really like you as you really are if you never give them a chance to see who you are? So that's the way people often operate, right? So finally they will forget this. I'm just going to be myself. I'm just going to kind of not make any effort anymore to try to have people like me. And lo and behold, then by being yourself, then it gives people a chance to like you. And then people start hanging out with you or whatever, something like that. Make some sense? And there's a lot to be said in life in allowing for possibilities to arise which are unknown to you. And if we're constantly in control, which sometimes we are, if we're very confident in our desires and our abilities, sometimes we're constantly in control. And sometimes we might be successful in trying to get what we want. But sometimes we miss out on wonderful opportunities that only surface if there's a kind of sense of allowing for some unknown thing to happen. So I find it much wiser in life to allow for the unknown as part of what we do, as part of the scene. It's like when I write now, sometimes I do a lot of writing, and I used to be very difficult for me to write, like pulling teeth or something. And it's still not so easy for me to write, but it became a lot easier when I realized that I didn't have to know the end of the sentence when I started the sentence. So allow for something new to happen, something unknown. Yes, please.
What's the relation? How far is letting go to generating bodhicitta?
Oh, if you let go, bodhicitta is a natural state of who we are. It's kind of like a core, the essence of who we are. And so if we let go thoroughly, that essence shows itself. And the more we let go, I think the stronger the bodhicitta will operate.
Now, one way to do it. So that's the one way to do it.
That's one way to develop bodhicitta. So you find different Buddhist teachers emphasizing different ways of developing bodhicitta. Some emphasize to actively develop it through the cultivation of compassion and reflection, and other people who emphasize it by not emphasizing it, in a sense, just let go, and it'll surface naturally on its own. So, anyway, like in Tibetan Buddhism, there tends to be generally, in most schools of Tibetan Buddhism, an active attempt to develop it. But in some Tibetan schools, like in Dzogchen tradition, they often let it just arise naturally in the context of Dzogchen practice. That's my experience. Is that a satisfying answer for you?
No, yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yes?
We heard that while you were away, you went to Dalai Lama.
When I came back from that, I gave a Sunday morning talk on that topic. Those tapes are available. I mean, that's, you know, you can listen to that. But the Dalai Lama, I was a spirit rock for a 5-6 day Buddhist teachers convention. That's a thing to do, right? When you get together all your colleagues and you have these conventions and you wear name tags. And Buddhism meets the modern world. And then we had the keynote speaker. So it was quite special to have the Dalai Lama come. He came, he was there for about 24 hours. And you know, it's a little bit odd because, as you all know, the Dalai Lama is not the Pope of Buddhism. And so all these different Buddhist traditions have no relationship to him. But the purity and the strength of the intention of this particular Dalai Lama is so great that pretty much everyone's ready to offer him tremendous respect. So he charmed us. I mean, it was really beautiful to have him come. And it was quite touching for me to hear some of the things he wanted to say. He kept saying, for example, "I'm just a humble monk." And it was 20 minutes left before he had to actually leave. And one of the facilitators told him that, you know, 20 minutes left, you know, to say something really important. Oh, this is a gathering of all these Western Buddhist Dharma teachers. And, you know, what? And he just, what do you expect from me? What would I have to tell you? He was kind of humble and felt very sincere. He was asked about blessings. In the Tibetan scene, there's a tremendous emphasis on receiving blessings from the guru or the Rinpoche or someone. And he said, you know, "I don't have any blessings to give. I don't really understand this. It's kind of troublesome for me. I'm just a simple Buddhist monk. You know, I don't have any blessings to give." He emphasized, you know, that the importance of the sincerity of our intention, that it is very important to pay attention to the intention for Dharma teachers when they're teaching and when they're practicing. The teacher meeting in general was quite inspiring, to be in a room full of over 200 people who had been doing, most of them had done probably, you know, over 20 years of Buddhist practice. And some pretty serious practice in order to become teachers. And then I had the feeling that there was a rare gathering of adults. people who are, you know, pretty mature people. It was kind of nice to be around that and to feel the sincerity that went into all those people's years of practice. And I really enjoyed being there with all those people. And it was also very nice that it was a meeting of all the different Buddhist traditions in the West, a lot of them at least. And to all sit together in one room as friends and colleagues and not have any jostling for status and position, and, you know, my tradition is better than your tradition kind of thing. And we're just all, you know, we were all just people kind of doing our best and sharing. There was a opportunity for my wife and two and a half year old son to go up there and have a little audience with Dalai Lama. And so my wife told my son that he was going to go see the Dalai Lama that day. And he said, "Oh, the big alpaca?" So should we end with a little bit more letting go? So actually this time in the last 10 minutes, instead of practicing letting go, involvement. Don't reject it or throw it away or get rid of it. Just let it be in its simplicity. Nothing extra, nothing added. So thank you all, and may your letting go give lots of room for your wisdom to surface. Thank you.